Aloha. Aloha, Professor Mariner.
Aloha.
Hi. I just want to do a quick introduction to our listeners here. Joining me on the phone is Professor Mariner. He is a chemistry professor at Stanford. He is also the winner of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry last year. He and a couple of his associates won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry last year, and for his pioneering work in microscopy. So I want to, first of all, Dr. Mariner is here. I mean, Professor Mariner is here, W.E. Mariner. He is a keynote speaker at the Nonlinear Optics Conference, which is being held down at the Kauai Marriott. And it actually, scientists and engineers have come from all over the world to attend this. And he was a keynote speaker there this morning, if I got that correct. And so welcome, Professor Mariner.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. It's very exciting to be here for this nonlinear optics meeting, which is organized by the Optical Society of America. That's been coming to Hawaii for many, many years.
So maybe for people like myself, what exactly is nonlinear optics?
Well, it turns out to cover a very wide range of optical effects. That is, effects that you can study with light and with lasers. And we're here partly celebrating 2015 as the International Year of Light. It's being celebrated all over the world, and all of the science relating to light and uses of light and lasers is really being explored and discussed. But essentially, nonlinear optics means what can happen when you have very intense laser beams.
And so now the work that you did that helped you win the Nobel Prize, can you talk a little bit about what that was and is?
Yeah, I can. It takes a couple of levels of explanation, so I'd like to work through that bit by bit to make sure that we get the various pieces explained. First of all, we need to get an idea of the scale of what we're talking about. And if you think of your human hair, it has a diameter of about 100 microns. Micrometers, millionths of a meter. And if you go down by a factor of 100 to about 1 micron, you're close to the wavelength of visible light. That is, visible light, green light, has a wavelength of about 0.5 micron. And light, as you know, is a wave. So that's one of the scales that's important in explaining what's going on. The next thing you want to think about is that the cells in our bodies, are about 10 microns in size, 10 micrometers. And, of course, they all have wonderful functions and do different things. But if you now think about what's inside of a cell, it's very much like a little city with many, many very tiny objects all running around doing their jobs to make the cell work. And the size of all those objects is 1,000 times smaller, down in the 10 nanometer range. So from 10 microns down by 1,000 to 10 nanometers. That's where the real action goes on inside the cells in our body. And we have been wanting to observe what's happening in cells with light. And scientists have been doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years since the microscope was first invented, to first see the entire cell, but now we want to see more and more of what's inside the cell, the individual little machines that are running around inside, or the little structures that are inside.
Well, I was kind of amazed. I did a little bit of reading when I knew I was going to interview you, that the microscope fundamentally has been used a lot the same since the 17th century. Is that correct?
That's right.
Wow.
That's exactly right. The fundamental components of the microscope really haven't changed very much in that long time. But the beauty of using light to look at a cell is that light doesn't really damage the cell very much. It essentially can probe the cell without having to blast it apart or take it into pieces like it might happen if you hit the cell with X-rays or hit it with other things that were much, much more energetic. So the beauty of light is that you can watch without destroying. However, the really important point to get across is that even up until about 10 years ago, so from the 17th century up to about 10 years ago, every microscope has been fundamentally blurry, fundamentally out of focus. And so let me try to explain that a little bit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I was saying that there are these little tiny objects which are down on the scale of 10 nanometers or 1 nanometer inside the cell. But if you try to look at those with light, with an optical microscope, you really can't see things with finer detail less than roughly the wavelength divided by 2, that 500 nanometers divided by 2. Remember I said the wavelength of light was about 500 nanometers. So 250 nanometers is the smallest thing that you can see easily. Below that, they just look blurry. So the problem with optical microscopes has been they were fundamentally blurry, always out of focus. You couldn't do any better by buying a better microscope or anything like that to make the structures be clear and in focus until the research of the Nobel Prize, which basically means we have been able to demonstrate something we call super resolution. That means that we now can use optical microscopes to see that very fine detail down to the tens of nanometer level.
So what kind of implications does this new sort of technology have, you know, for people for medicine? I mean, if you're talking about looking at human cells, what sort of doorways does this open, do you think?
Yeah, it opens a whole bunch of doorways in a lot of exciting ways. But for the basic reason that before this most recent work, I just want to make sure that's clear, if you tried to look down inside the microscope and see what was going on, it looked blurry, and you couldn't make it any better by changing focus or anything like that because it was a fundamental fuzziness. But these new techniques let us see what's there. So this is the key exciting part. If you previously had a veil before your eyes and you couldn't see, now the veil is lifted in a way so that now we can see structures that we couldn't see before, structures and little machines moving around. So it's just like, coming into a new world to try to understand how this cell works.
Almost like if you had cataract surgery, now you can see clearer again.
It's exactly like that in a way, okay?
Right.
It's not precisely,
right. Yeah, of course.
But it's the same idea, that they were blurry and fuzzy, and with the new super resolution, all of a sudden they look very sharp and fine, and you can see what's there. Because, you know, if you someone who has a very bad cataract, can't really distinguish different things or see whether there's one or two or whatever, and then once you can be in clear focus, you can see what's really there. So it's really a revolution for cell biology, for understanding cells, and you can use that in both healthy cells as well as in diseased cells, which lead to human diseases and other problems. So for example, there are a number of neurodegenerative diseases that our world is worrying about now with aging populations. And many of those diseases, like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and so on, involve creation of tiny aggregates or tiny little clusters of proteins inside cells. Huntington's disease is the one that we actually have worked on, and Huntington's disease arises from mutant Huntington protein, that's the name of the protein, that all of us have, but those people who have mutant Huntington form these aggregates inside cells and inside the cells in the brain. And without super resolution, you can't see those very tiny little aggregates at all. You can only see huge clumps that are really big, but we can see the tiny ones now and try to understand what they mean and what they're doing and what role they have. So that's an example. We haven't, of course, cured these diseases yet, but we expect with this much better information that the chance of us being able to do that will greatly increase over time. Scientists all over the world are beginning to use these methods now.
Well, thank you so much. I want to, for people who've just tuned in, I want to let you know that right now I'm speaking with Professor W.E. Murner. He's a keynote speaker at the Nonlinear Optics Conference that's being presented and sponsored by the Optical Society of America here on Kauai. And he is also the 2014 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. for the work that he's done, which he's been talking a little bit to us about. Also, he reminded us that, which he reminded me and you, well, you probably didn't even know, that the United Nations has listed the year 2015, declared it the International Year of Light and Light-Based Technologies. And so when you say, like, the work that you do with this microscope, what you created, was that so more light can actually be used? I mean, does this have anything to do with the light, or is that?
Yes, it has a lot to do with the light. So let me explain a little bit about how that part works. In order to do this thing that I was telling you about, super resolution, let me explain that often when we want to see what's going on inside cells, and let's suppose we want to look at one particular kind of protein that's in the cell. So there's thousands of proteins, but we want to look at just one of them, one type. We want to look at one type. So we will hook what's called a fluorescent molecule to that type of protein. It's a fluorescent molecule is a molecule that emits light when we stimulate it with a laser beam. If we stimulate it, let's say, with green light, these molecules will emit orange light. They'll emit a longer wavelength. And that's, of course, one of the key parts of being able to see inside the cell. We irradiate with the green light, and we see orange light only from the molecules, the proteins that we're wanting to see. Okay? Are you with me on that part?
Yes.
And I said that they were fluorescent molecules just to make sure we connect to what I mean by that is, you may have seen kids running around with shoes that shine, glow in the dark sometimes, or they're bright yellow or pink or orange, and sometimes people call them day glow, or there's day glow shoelaces or things like that. It's fluorescent molecules that produce that funny, beautiful colored light that's coming from those things that are that have fluorescent molecules in them. And those are the same kind of molecules we use to light up the structures inside the cell. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But now, the key point of how all this works, I want to explain a little bit about how it works because it's really, really beautiful. We make this work by building on some discoveries that happened in my lab back in 1989, more than 25 years ago. A postdoc named Lothar Kador and I were the first to optically detect a single molecule, just one molecule. Now, that by itself sounds very esoteric. Okay, who cares if you can detect one single molecule? But it turns out that's one of the critical keys that let us be able to see without being blurry in these cells today. The original work was very esoteric, but that's what happens in science. Investments in basic research over the years get used and expanded and developed and thought about by many different people all over the world, and that's what's happened in this case too. A lot of people started studying individual molecules. At first, it was, if you like, a tour de force, you know, something that had no one ever done before. Well, let's do it. But because you can see singles, now think about this problem going back to the cell. If I imagine a structure in there, a structure inside the cell, and I have decorated it with these tiny little fluorescent molecules, if I work under conditions where only a few of them are emitting this fluorescence, then they're going to look like little separated dots of light, little tiny separated dots of light. And by seeing those separated ones, I can find out where they are. I can measure in the microscope where those molecules are and do that again and again, which then lets me figure out the shape of the structure that they're attached to. So that's the basic idea, but let me try to explain it several different ways so it can hopefully become clear. We basically look at a cell, and we work under conditions where the molecules are emitting, and those molecules are telling us, you know, where they are by the light that they emit. like a spot, you know. If I see the spot on my camera, then I can just measure the position X, Y. I can measure where that molecule is. They're very much like fireflies. If you've ever heard of fireflies that glow in the dark at night, that's what these molecules are like. They're like little points of light, or like the stars in the sky. But the positions of those molecules are telling us where that structure is, where the structure of interest is located. And because we can watch them molecule by molecule, we get great detail on the positions that are along the structure. It's something like sampling the structure with little tiny dots. How's that? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I'll tell you what, I'm glad you use that analogy of fireflies, because those are just always one of the most magical things I've ever seen when I was a small child, and I still have fond memories of seeing those and how exciting it was.
Yeah, me too, right? I really enjoyed that, watching fireflies at night. But now if you just imagine shrinking that down from, you know, millimeters and inches and so forth, all the way down by millions of times, all the way down to this nanometer level, now those fireflies, each one of the molecules is only about 1 nanometer in size, 1 nanometer. And so it's a beautiful tiny light source that lights up the structure that we want to observe. And our movies, our data, the data we take is very much just like watching a bunch of flashes of light that keep changing for each new picture in the movie, which tells us where the molecules are inside the cell.
Wow. If you just tuned in, I'm speaking with Professor W.E. Murner. He is a professor of chemistry at Stanford University. He is also one of the winners of a 2014 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And I'm so glad he's taking some time, because he's at a conference right now. He's a keynote speaker there to share some of this exciting information with us, especially since this year has been declared the International Year of Light and Light-Based Technologies by the United Nations. And he's telling us some of the amazing things scientists are doing with light. And
In fact, it's really, really a lot of fun to use light and lasers to observe molecules, in this case single molecules, and apply that to important problems in our understanding of cells and how cells work. But these ideas also can be applied to understanding solids, polymers, other kinds of systems, because when we can look at this ultimate level of individual molecules, we get a precision and depth of information that just wasn't possible before.
Could you talk a little bit about the importance of, I mean, well, what just basically, what is light?
Well, you know, I always like to say I can't tell you exactly what it is, but I sure know it when I see it.
How do you think? What do you think about the light here on Kauai?
You know, there's a deep scientific answer to your question, and I'm not sure you want that answer. But
no, but I like your chuckle.
But you know, light is what we call an electromagnetic wave. To just make sure that we connect, because you know what I really want is, I'd really love for students to ask themselves that question too. What is light? Because if you study chemistry and physics, and optics, you can learn exactly what light is. It turns out it's a wave. It's what we call an electromagnetic wave. That means it has both electric fields, okay, just like you may have observed when you rub your coat on the carpet and you get a shock. There are electric fields, and then there's magnetic fields, just like you get from magnets. But the electrical and the magnetic fields are hooked together in light, and they run together and propagate through space. And that's exactly what light really is.
Well, thank you. And right now I'm speaking with Professor Murner. And, you know, I'm always interested, because I like to get to know people. Like, what, I mean, how old were you when you decided that you were going to dedicate your life to science? I mean, did you always have, like, interest, like, when you were a small child? I mean, what... when did you sort of realize that science was going was your passion?
Well, that's a great question. Let me just say that I just can't remember when I didn't like science. Mm-hmm. There was so many interesting mysteries when I was a kid growing up. Of course, I had fun doing chemistry experiments in the chemistry building that I had in the back of my yard. It was like a metal box, and we could do experiments there. I played with electronics and electrical things, and my parents were incredibly supportive of me learning as much science as possible. I'm really from the Sputnik generation, when students were encouraged to study science and mathematics, and of course that's still important now. Even if there's no Sputnik right now, there's a worldwide need for people to understand technology and how the world works in its precise detail. And we need that sorely in the United States, because many other countries in the world are encouraging young scientists much more than we are, and we have a risk of getting behind. But in any case, the early days were days of fun and exploration and asking the question, how does this work? How does this work? And early on, it's not so easy to get the final answer of how things work. It does take years of study to build up enough mathematics and so forth to understand exactly how they work. But there still can be great fun along the way. I got involved in amateur radio. I got involved in science clubs and all sorts of things like that in and out of school, which gave me a wonderful springboard to study science. And I'm still a student of science, it turns out. I'm still learning. My degree may be in physics, but I'm in a chemistry department. We're doing biology, and we're learning about cells. It's a continuous, wonderful exploration of the world. So that's the key thing. Students need to ask the question, how does this work? How does it really work? You're holding a cell phone in your hand that is filled with unbelievably complicated devices, and we are going to have more and more of those in our world that we need to understand. And this just goes on and on. We have global problems of climate change. We have needs for renewable energy and clean water. All of these things will be solved by more and more science.
You are listening to Kauai Community Radio. It's 1:32 here on the Garden Island. Joining me via the phone is Professor W.E. Murner. He is a professor at Stanford University, and he's also a winner of Nobel Prize in Chemistry last year in 2014, he and his team. And I'm also curious, I mean, there's so much, like you said, what was it, 1989, the first time you got one of these major discoveries that sort of snowballed into winning this Nobel Prize. That's the impression, I'm pretty sure that's what I heard you say. So, I mean, sometimes I think people think, oh, well, you know, they just did something real quick and won the prize. But can you just talk a little bit about what goes into, you know, this kind of discovery? I mean, I know it gets different in different fields, but...
Sure, yes. Well, that original work was done while I was a research scientist at IBM Research in San Jose, California, working on optical storage of digital data. Okay, we have to store bits in our computers and our cell phones, and we were working on optical storage. And the original discovery came out of that fundamental work on optical storage. So it came out of the clear blue, out of another area of science, but because we were asking the fundamental questions, how do things really work, then we were able to detect a single molecule. Now, the important point to answer your question is that the process of science is a sequence of studying and studying and studying and studying. We first studied these molecules at low temperatures, very low temperatures, liquid helium, near absolute zero. Then the molecules were studied at room temperature. Some people showed that they could be detected at room temperature. Some people showed that they could be detected in a different way. We needed the molecules to be able to be turned on and off. We needed them to be both dark and bright, because that's a critical aspect of making this super resolution work. That was something that we discovered as a surprise in 1997, okay, many years after the first experiment. And so there's a continuing flow of exploring a new boundary, learning something new, moving to explore another boundary. Each time one thing is discovered and understood, that sort of opens the door to the next thing that could be known and understood. And so that's why it takes some time period to build on one discovery and another and another and another and another. And finally, with the other two laureates, who were they were very much focused on removing this fundamental fuzziness in images, they used some of the ideas that I had put together from my earlier work, so that the work is not only spread out in time but for by individuals, but combines aspects from different people's work to open new doors into new discoveries.
So I'm just curious, are the, I know, like, these other two people, are these people that you have actually, like, spent time with in the lab, or are these people that you have, I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, well, what happens in science is that people publish their work in journals that people read, and we talk about it at conferences, just like this conference that's here in Kauai. That this one is organized by the Optical Society of America. The American Physical Society runs conferences. American Chemical Society runs conferences. At these meetings, scientists get together and talk about their latest, most exciting results. So the other two laureates were friends and colleagues, but not direct collaborators. Eric Betzig was also at Cornell University, like I was. And although we were not working in the same group, and then he went to Bell Laboratories, and I went to IBM Laboratories, and the most exciting science reported by top scientists are read by other scientists, because you want to know what's going on, because that always gives another idea for your work to go further in another direction. So my work influenced Betzig, Betzig's work influenced me. The other person named Stefan Hell from Germany came at this from a slightly different direction, but he also used this switching property of molecules to achieve super resolution by a slightly different approach. So we learn about people's work through their publications and through presentations at conferences. That's basically how it's done. And these days, of course, people are using the web more and more for disseminating information about their research and learning about new research.
Right. And so if you just tune in, I'm speaking with Professor W.E. Murner. He is at the Nonlinear Optics Conference here on Kauai, which is sponsored by the Optical Society of America. He was the keynote speaker at this conference. He's also a professor at Stanford, and he is a winner of the 2014 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And now, for people who are listening, like, one of my best friends, her daughter is going to be majoring in chemistry. So I told her, please listen to this, listen to this interview. But I mean, I just would like to give some advice to, you know, people who are, especially our youth. Like you said, we definitely need people to branch out into the sciences. And I know there's been a lot of movement, especially to get women involved with STEM. That's kind of been in the news a lot. Could you talk a little bit about, I mean, what can you offer people listening that, to maybe encourage them or inspire them to go into these fields? Like, what have you gained, some, you know, in your life? You've been, as you said, since you're very young, interested in science. I guess there does have to be some kind of propensity to science, but there's, you know, there's always a people that they have that propensity, but maybe there's just something holding them back.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, luckily these days there's a wonderful effort to draw underrepresented groups, especially women, minorities, and so forth, into all of the areas where they should be in science and in other fields. And there's a tremendous opportunity now, because doors have been opened in this respect. But I just want to say that what's really important to be a scientist is to have that inner desire to understand how things work. Why are these beautiful plants outside here in Hawaii green? Why are some red? Why are some yellow? What are the molecules that makes that happen? Why do they extract energy from sunlight? How do they extract that energy from sunlight? Precisely, how do they do it? And so on. There has to be this deep desire of understanding how things work. And let me just say that when you do figure it out, when you do, you know, learn some of these mysteries and answers to some of these mysteries, it's really fun. It is very, very exciting to say, ah, that's how it works. And that is what science is about. It's about understanding how things really work. What explanations of the behavior are consistent with the laws of nature? That's what science is asking and answering. And it's very, very exciting, and I want to encourage young students, male, female, and of any persuasion and so forth, to consider this and to take it as a field. There's tremendous improvements in the number of female mentors now in the science fields. At Stanford in the chemistry department, we've been excited to hire several female faculty members. I have huge numbers of female students in my group, and always have. Many of my students are tenured faculty members at universities all over the world, or in really exciting jobs, or involved in other sorts of professions. So it's a very exciting time, and that's really all I can say about that. That I want you to say that success in science builds on a deep curiosity about things, how things work, and a passion for that understanding. Everybody in any field that they're thinking about must have a passion. Must have, and this is the passion that you need in science: the will and the desire to understand how it works, and the curiosity to explore things that have not been explored before.
And I'm just before we close, is there any place online people can find out more about you? Or I mean, do you have your own website? I know you're on the Stanford website. Do you happen to have your own website or anything?
My website is hosted at Stanford. Mm-hmm. In other words, my group's website is essentially my website. Mm-hmm. It has details of what we're working on now. It has details about who we are. It has details about me. And I don't really maintain a separate website. Mostly what I do is to document the beautiful work of my students and postdocs on the group website. But I have a Wikipedia page, so you can mm-hmm. certainly look me up on the Wikipedia page, which is a good place to start because it's got some of the fundamentals, but then it has links to the group web page and lots of other information.
Oh, wonderful. So now would someone just type in W.E. Mirner? Okay, so
that's it.
Professor Mirner's last name is spelled M-O-E-R-N-E-R, W.E. Mirner, M-O-E-R-N-E-R. Well, I want to thank you so much. I know you have the conference to get back to. I want to thank you so much, Professor Mirner, because this is very exciting for me. I've never been like one of these science kind of people, but I love what science does for us. And my husband is an engineer, so
great.
I told him,
I'm like,
I'm going to be interviewing this person. And
wonderful, yeah. I have some engineering training too, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, I saw
Tracy,
that.
It was so exciting to chat with you, and I really appreciate your interest and encouragement.
Well, thank you, and I hope you get some time away from the conference so you get to explore the beautiful light here on Kauai.
We certainly will. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, and I do want to say, when I read the little information about you on the Stanford website, how you had turned, when you actually had won the Nobel Prize, you turned your phone off because you were in a conference.
Yeah, that's right. And my wife, Sharon, was the person who told me first about the prize because I was in Brazil at the time and my phone was not working. She had to send me an email essentially to say, turn on your radio, whatever. Turn on your TV.
No, I think that's. I love that story. And then I especially love the part that she got you a first class seat coming home.
That's right. But she is wonderful.
Yes, she is. So anyway, I just wanted to share that because I thought that was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Professor Murner, and if you're ever back in Kauai, I'd love to have you come into the studio live and meet you in person, and we could talk more.
Thank you. It was a wonderful pleasure.
Okay, thank you so much, and enjoy Kauai and the conference.
I will.
Okay, aloha.
Aloha.
Okay, well, that was fun. And so coming back to some music now, we have Matis Yahu doing a cover of John Lennon's Watching the Wheels. That's it, Watching the Wheels. Okay. Thanks so much for tuning in to Kauai Community Radio.